This talk was given at Insight Meditation South Bay. For more information and a schedule of our events, visit the Insight Meditation South Bay website at www.imsb.org. For information about online programs, visit the Bodhi Courses website at www.bodhicourses.org. Bodhi is spelled B-O-D-H-I.
I'm delighted to be with you tonight. Happy to be here. And as Sharon mentioned, tonight the topic is right mindfulness, relating to right mindfulness. And I'm just curious, how many of you have been here for some or most of the Noble Eightfold Path teachings so far? Okay, many of you. Great. So I like that it's being presented out of the standard order listed in the suttas. And the standard order is right view, right intention, right speech, right action, livelihood, effort, mindfulness, and concentration. And when you read the scriptures, it's almost always listed the same way over and over again, which gives this idea that it's a really linear process. But my own experience of it is it's a little bit more like a web or a matrix. It's interdependent. Each of these factors informs all of the others. So it's delightful to have it shuffled a little bit. Mindfulness is an important part of this matrix. It's only one part, but it's the part that clues us in. It clues you in as to whether or not you're engaged with any or all of the other parts, and whether or not you're engaged with mindfulness itself. So it's one piece, but an important piece. I'm going to do something a little bit non-standard and talk about the history of the word itself for a few minutes. I'm a bit of a Buddhist geek, and I find this stuff fascinating. So the Pali word that's usually translated as mindfulness is sati. There's actually a bunch of other words that can be translated as mindfulness too, but we're not going to go there tonight because we're talking about sati. Mindfulness as a word didn't become the standard translation for sati until around 1910. And it was then that Caroline and Thomas W. Rhys-Davids in England translated the Satipatthana Sutta together, husband and wife team. And their translation was the first to take mindfulness and really use it as a term. And because they were head of the Pali Text Society, that was pretty influential, and it became the standard from then on. But I thought it'd be interesting to read you some of the words that were used before mindfulness was used. Now, this reading dictionary definitions can be, you know, dry, so I'm going to offer for you to drop into your body and notice in your heart and your body how each of these words kind of lands for you, and if there's a difference between mindfulness as a word and some of the others. Memory. Recognition. Consciousness. Intentness. Alertness. Self-possession. Conscience. And lucidity of mind. That's my favorite, that last one. So up until 1910, you could have run into any of those words talking about mindfulness meditation. It could have been intentness meditation or conscience meditation, right? And as you're probably well aware, mindfulness itself has become a celebrity word in the last few years. It's everywhere. You can be mindful of anything: wardrobe, fashion, colors, how to cross the street, anything, right? And in partial response to that, some translators have begun actually using other words again. And Bhikkhu Bodhi is now preferring the term lucid awareness, which I think is quite beautiful, actually. Lucid awareness. So tonight we're talking about right mindfulness, so I want to take a few minutes to talk about the right part, too. Have other teachers in this series talked about the right word? Yeah? So I'll just spend a couple seconds on it. In the Pali translations, the ancient language that was first written, the canon was first written in, the literal early translation of samma, which means right, was the pin of a yoke. And I mean the yoke like a yoke that goes around an ox's neck to pull a cart. But it's not just the yoke itself, it's the actual pin that holds it together, kind of like the linchpin. And I think that, for me, is a great image. It's kind of like, holds it all together. And the term that came out of that is connected in one. Connected in one. Other words are, and again, you can feel this in your body if you want to, thoroughly, rightly, properly, right? As it ought to be. Best. There's also, though, connotations not just of thorough, but of harmony. So, other translations of this entire term could be thoroughly connected lucid awareness, or harmony of consciousness. So I think it's fun to play with the language, because you see, we always make choices when we render our experience into words. And then translators need to make choices again when they render another language into words. And there's no one word that's perfect. So I invite you to play in your own heart and your own mind with how you see this, how you feel it in your experience. Part of the reason I talk about this is the word right can be kind of problematic for some of us here in the West. There's a right mindfulness, there has to be a wrong mindfulness, right? Well, actually, there is a wrong mindfulness listed in the canon, guys. And I'm going to read a little bit and talk just a little bit about what that is, so that we can settle into what the ancient teachers meant when they were talking about wrong mindfulness, miccha sati. So the wrong mindfulness is an unhelpful attendance or relationship to an object. And so one classic example in the texts is these are often male monastics that are being talked about. And it's considered unhelpful for them to regard beautiful women in a certain way. Which makes sense if you're a celibate man, right? So not to attend to things in such a way that increases sensual desire was something very important back in these monastic, very simple, austere environments. These days, maybe that's not the main thing to attend to, right, in terms of right mindfulness or wrong mindfulness. And even back then, There were other examples. So let's see here. This is a sutta called the Anagana Sutta, Without Blemishes. And it's talking about here some of the things that a practitioner might attend to that would aggravate or agitate the mind. It is possible that a practitioner might wish, oh, that the teacher might teach by asking me all the questions. And if someone else gets asked, they become resentful or angry. Other wishes are, oh, that we might enter the village for food and alms, putting me in the forefront of the line, not somebody else. Anger, bitterness, resentment, if not happening. Another one is, might I get the best seat, the best water? Might I teach the Dhamma to others? And if someone else gets appointed, angerness and bitterness. Might I be the one to get superior robe, superior food, superior status? It goes on a little bit like this, right? I actually find this sutta comforting because it points to the fact that people are people and that it's easy to slide off into attending to things that aren't so helpful for our minds. Attending to things in a way that builds resentment or anger or bitterness or hopelessness instead of clarity, calm, kindness. Resentment didn't stop in ancient India. It's been one of the things I've worked with in my own practice, to be honest with you. And with wrong mindfulness, it's really easy to attend to something that is unwholesome, that is unhelpful, that's painful, and pump it up, increase it. My friend, that friend is terrible. She never calls me anymore. She dumped me. You know, next thing you know, I'm loveless, I'm abandoned, I'm lost. Papancha, perseveration of mind over wrong mindfulness. So right mindfulness, by contrast, softens around things like blame and inner criticism and notices them for the unhelpful thought processes they are. It also is held by and it balances the other path factors. And by that I mean pure mindfulness, pure awareness, which is one part of mindfulness, can allow all sorts of things to rise up in the mind. And while it's very helpful not to take too active of a role in pushing away or squelching, it's also helpful to allow being on this beautiful Buddhist path to inform the quality of the mindfulness and the awareness itself. And I'll just give a couple examples from my own practice. So there are two other path factors that are particularly helpful for me when I'm sitting, whether it's on a chair, on a cushion, or standing, waiting for the bus, meditating. The first is related to what Sharon talked about last week in the right effort category, which is one of the conditions for right effort, the arousing of enthusiasm or zeal. But it's a particular kind of enthusiasm or zeal. It's an enthusiasm for cultivating what is beneficial within and helping it increase and allowing, encouraging what's not so helpful to wither, die down, and remain away or die down. I would add for myself that when it comes through, just let it come through, but don't get hooked by it. like, oh, there it went. Okay. That was a thought. So this arousal of zeal for me is often just really helpful at to be held at the level of intention when first beginning to practice. Not as an active thing, but just, okay, this is the context of why I'm here. The second kind of other factor is intention. Now, the arousal of enthusiasm is a kind of intention, but this other intention I'm talking about is an intention of gentleness, kindness, compassion. The intention is helpful even when the emotion doesn't show up. Those two together, some people find helps them really observe cause and effect in the mind, how the mind unfolds in a way that begins to naturally incline towards what is beneficial and naturally let go of what isn't. And if we polled everyone in the room, and there's some very long-time practitioners in this room, each of us are going to have our own flavor about how that works. This is just an example about how a little bit of the matrix works together in one mind. And you can try it on for yourself and see how it works. The key for me in right mindfulness is to understand the difference between discerning and judging. It's okay to discern. You're not going to hear that from everybody about mindfulness, but you'll hear it from me. And it's okay to discern all the levels of what works and what doesn't, and to hold it very lightly. Mindfulness, it's in the suttas, I believe, as well as the commentaries, is likened to being a gatekeeper. Watches what comes in or who comes in. You're going to keep track of who's in the village of the mind at any given point and what they might be up to. And then sometimes you can even watch things leave again, which can be helpful too. Another metaphor for right mindfulness is face-to-face with something. And when face-to-face, you don't have to be here. It's okay to step back and give whatever's there a lot of space. But looking at it, oh, I see you. I see you. So there's some other ways to consider right mindfulness as well. The Satipatthana Sutta that I mentioned earlier could be its own series, or its own definitely quite long talk, so I'm not going to really dig into it at all, but in order to talk about right mindfulness, it seems important to at least mention it. Satipatthana is often translated as the four foundations of mindfulness. Tanissaro Bhikkhu uses the term four frames of reference, which is kind of a nice way to think about it as well. And for me personally, I find it helpful to think of four foundational modalities of mindfulness, four ways of perceiving, modes of perception, of experience. And I've just been talking about one of them, the last one, the fourth, which is mindfulness of dhammas. Mindfulness of dhammas includes mind states, emotions, thoughts, wholesome and unwholesome. That's the fourth. But the other three, particularly the first two, really help support that understanding. And the first, as almost all of you know, is the body. And the body is really useful because it's always here and it's always right now in the body. It's hard to get away off too far into the ether if I'm being grounded at my feet or my belly. There's also feeling tone, vedana, classically described as pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant or unpleasant. This is an incredibly helpful form of right mindfulness, because noticing whether something is pleasant or unpleasant is a really good way to keep from building an entire house of cards around it later. I can come up with entire theories about something based on whether it's pleasant or unpleasant if I don't catch that initial hit. Unrecognized vedana is like the sepia tint on a photograph or special effects on a movie. If we don't notice it right away, it can distort everything you see. And sometimes it's rose-colored glasses, and sometimes it's something really unpleasant. The third level, the third foundational modality of mindfulness is awareness of mind itself. And that's as simple as awareness of awareness itself. Sayadaw Utejaniya talks about, encourages people to use their intelligence with this foundation. And almost like a little vipassana koan. Am I aware? Are you aware right now? What of? Of course, it's kind of a trick, because if you can ask yourself that question, guess what? For me, I find also that my Zen training has been very helpful in this area. These four foundations are really beautiful. They're like basic literacy in a way. We can divide up our experience by these different ways of feeling into it. But it's also okay to just be immersed in a field of experience. I actually ran across the Pali term for this quite by accident yesterday. Parimukkan sating upatetung is to surround oneself with watchfulness of mind, to immerse oneself in a field. There is an analogy in the suttas about a cowherd watching the cows in the field graze. No need to control if the cows are doing well. No need to get too close. Just let them graze. But boy, if there's a drought or those cows are restless, you might want to get a little closer. So many times, just a simplicity, being simply aware, can be really helpful. There's another piece of the Satipatthana Sutta that talks about right mindfulness across any and all of these ways of perceiving it. And it's right at the beginning. I have it in my notes, but I think I'd rather read it from the book because it's a little bit more... Yes. The book I'm holding here is The Middle-Length Discourses of the Buddha. It's also called the Majjhima Nikaya. And it's considered to be the handbook of meditation for monastics originally, and more recently, in the last few centuries, for us lay people. It's one of several nikayas, or groups of text, that contain suttas, or stories, teaching stories. And there's also two other larger baskets of text, which I won't go into right now. So, general way of approaching mindfulness in the Satipatthana Sutta, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. Here, a practitioner abides contemplating the body as a body, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. She then contemplates feelings as feelings in the same way. I'm riffing a little here, folks. Contemplates mind as mind, ardent, fully aware and mindful, and contemplates mind objects, dhammas, as mind objects. I love that phrase, mindful, ardent, and alert, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. Ardency, that enthusiasm, right? By putting away covetousness and grief, it doesn't mean not necessarily always experiencing it. It means allowing it to pass through, not getting hooked by it, not getting reactive to it or charged with it. And then at the highest, most subtle, deepest forms of practice, it will fall away altogether. But in daily life, not sticky is really good. Just through, like clouds and sky. Another part of that refrain that I'm not reading from the book talks about internal and external mindfulness. And there's internal and external mindfulness of every single one of these four. So internal and external of body, of feelings, yes, of mind, and mind objects. And different people have different interpretations as to what all of those mean. But I'd like to posit a really simple way of looking at external and internal and external mindfulness, right mindfulness. For me, this is about linking my internal practice to the relational world, about how I show up, the impact, the cause and effect on others. So, my first year on the cushion, for example, I had had all this secular meditation experience, but I just started reading Buddhist books. I got really, really interested. I didn't have a teacher. I didn't have a sangha. I just started sitting every day. And not a lot was happening on the cushion, to be honest with you. I had the absolutely delightful experience of not knowing what I was doing and not being worried about it. But I kept at it, not because what was happening seemed very important on the cushion, but I was noticing that I was more patient, kinder, happier, and other people were noticing that too. So that was a really helpful metric, this external mindfulness and external feedback of the community around me. And that's not to say that on any given day one needs to measure that. I think the Dalai Lama says you should measure your meditation practice regularly, about once every 5 years. Right. But just to notice, you know, are you a little crunchier the days you don't meditate? Maybe a little calmer the days you do. The internal and external mindfulness really comes into play in relationships. That call and response that happens so often beneath the verbal level between each of us and all of us. And the way that an enhanced sensitivity to this heart and this body somehow, amazingly, can translate into an enhanced sensitivity of all the other hearts and bodies. And this is a choice to open the field of awareness wide, wider, include each and every person in it. So there's maybe an example here. There can be forms of Vipassana practice that are very detailed. You're noticing every little movement within a movement, every little intention within an intention. So it's possible to get very absorbed and very concentrated. And I've spent time at monasteries where people do this. And the instruction is your mindfulness. You're mindful when you're walking, when you're moving, when you're reaching, when you're grasping, when you're turning. And I've seen people incredibly mindful about all of that cut off another five people in the food line. They are not mindful of the expressions on their friends' faces or even the fact that there are other people there. So that's internal mindfulness that is operating in a way that's maybe nothing wrong for that person, but it's maybe not taking into account the internal and external mindfulness of the community. So we can very mindfully, happily be absorbed in cutting someone off, or worse, right? This kind of mindfulness happens on the highway a lot, I've noticed, right? A really helpful part of internal and external mindfulness is, again, to look at cause and effect. Cause and effect in this heart and the perceived effect on other hearts and minds. Not in a way of being self-conscious, but just notice. Noticing. Without judging, noticing. I'm not sure if this will be easily explainable, but one of the hallmarks of right mindfulness I haven't talked about yet is mindfulness of arising and passing away, of phenomenon, of experience. It can be a very powerful wisdom practice, on the cushion and off. And it can be helpful to even practice this in daily life. Watching the arising and disappearance of a mind state or an impulse in conversation. Here's another monastery story. This was in Burma during the rains retreats. It's hot, it's noisy, tin roof, rain. And, you know, it's probably, I mean, it's 100% humidity because it's raining like crazy, and it's in the high 90s, and it's about 10 o'clock at night. And I'm sitting up in the hall, and there's one other woman, a Korean bhikkhuni, who's also sitting in the hall. And I have a fan right on me, you know. I'm bald, but it doesn't help that much. And I'm finally done for the night, and everybody's kind of operating at their own schedule. And I get up to leave, and I notice that the fan's not really towards her, and she's sweating. So I did what I thought was a good thing, and I turned the fan very gently towards her before leaving. Kim may have heard this story already. About 2 minutes after I got down the stairs, I turned around to find myself faced with an absolutely irate Korean nun attempting to explain to me very angrily something in a language that I had absolutely no idea what she was saying. And a moment or two later, someone came up to interpret. But before that even happened, in that relationship, I was noticing the arising of a certain feeling state. And before I got a chance to speak, I realized that she was actually really upset. It was not just about being yelled at, that this being was really upset. and I watched the impulse switch from defensiveness to compassion. Now, when the interpreter came, I just want to finish the story for you. It turns out that there is a cultural belief among many Koreans, at least where she came from in the country, that having a fan on you makes you sick. So she was asking me over and over in an upset, slightly pleading voice, what were you doing? Why were you trying to make me sick? So completely mismatched intentions, right? Like, we were just... But I had no way to guess those intentions. So this is available to any of us at any time, right? To stop, to ground, to drop beneath whatever the surface chop is and tap into what it is that's helpful for the situation. I think it might be Joan Halifax Roshi, I may be misquoting her, that said, look for the juice in the room. Look for what's needed in the room. Internal and external mindfulness brings a we together. It can be a very powerful tool. So, I'd like to encourage you to consider the possibility that the field of mindfulness can encompass anything and everything. The minutiae of the experience of the breath, the body, thoughts, emotions, feelings, awareness itself, and also, perhaps most importantly, how we interrelate to each other in this beautiful, fragile world we live in. Thank you for your kind attention tonight.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.